Oh, if you knew her work, you just know immediately that that's Shirley Scott on the Hammond, the queen of jazz organ, on that album with Eddie Lockjaw Davis. They collaborated very frequently together, and that's titled In the Kitchen from the album of the same name. Shirley Scott on organ, George Duvivier, great bass player, and Arthur Edgehill on drums. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. It is Friday, July the 26th, and a lot to talk about today, so let's get started. Well, of course, the big news is yet another juror has come forward in the Zimmerman case to say that she had great anxiety about the verdict, and in fact, initially had said that she was going to vote for the second-degree murder charge and later changed her mind because of the instruction of the court. Well, let's hear what she has to say. She's talking with, in an exclusive interview with, on Nightline's Robin Roberts, and she's talking about the agony that she experienced in weighing the situation, knowing that in her heart of hearts that he was guilty. She even says that she thinks he got away with murder. So here is a juror. She's known only as Juror B29 and has further added some form of identity, calling herself only by the name Maddie. So here is Maddie talking with Miss Roberts of Nightline, and we'll be listening to it and come back after that and talk some more.
Dramatic moment for America when the jury in the George Zimmerman trial finally delivered a verdict, not guilty, adding fuel to a fire of racial tensions flaring across the country. But what was it like for the jurors themselves? Tonight, one woman comes forward to tell us what happened on the other side of those closed doors. ABC's Robin Roberts sat down for an exclusive interview with a woman who felt the weight of the world on her shoulders.
We, the jury, find George Zimmerman not guilty.
The not guilty verdict that set George Zimmerman free in the shooting death of 17-year-old Trayvon Martin rattled the nation, with many Americans questioning the jury's decision and wanting to ask the jurors a very tough question.
Some people have said George Zimmerman got away with murder. How do you respond to those people who say that?
George Zimmerman got away with murder, but you can't get away from God.
Juror B29, Maddie, came forward today in an ABC News exclusive interview. She said it wasn't an easy decision.
It's hard for me to sleep. It's hard for me to eat.
Yes. You haven't asked for money. You haven't asked for a book deal. You haven't asked for anything other than a forum to be able to tell your story.
Yeah. I don't need money. No money in this world could pay me to forget the pain that I'm going through. Trayvon Martin will always be in my heart.
But she wanted to talk about the verdict, how the jury reached it, and about what she sees as perhaps a higher justice.
At the end of the day, he's going to have a lot of questions and answers he has to deal with. The law couldn't prove it. We just have to believe in the Lord that if he has to pay, he will pay.
Maddie says putting her emotions aside and only considering the law was not easy.
I stand by the decision because of the law. If I stand by the decision because of my heart, he would have been guilty.
A 36-year-old mother of eight who calls herself a black Hispanic was the only minority on the jury. Since the verdict and the public backlash, she says she has been ridden with guilt.
I feel that I was forcibly included in Trayvon Martin's death.
The shooting death of 17-year-old Trayvon Martin brought the issue of race in America back to the forefront. After Zimmerman's acquittal, outrage ignited across the country.
So how do you respond when you see people who are making this about race, who are saying, had Trayvon not been a young black man, that the conversation would be different?
Is it true? That's a question that to be asked.
Even the president brought it up.
There are very few African-American men in this country who haven't had the experience of being followed when they were shopping in a department store. That includes me.
Just like Obama, I go to a lot of places and I get people to follow me sometimes.
Trayvon Martin's parents' reaction to the verdict echoes the feelings of many Americans.
I really didn't believe that he was not guilty.
While George Zimmerman has remained silent, his parents spoke to ABC News, offering an apology to Trayvon's family.
We are deeply sorry for this tragedy.
But for Trayvon Martin's parents, Sabrina Fulton and Tracy Martin, the fight for justice continues as they consider a civil suit.
It's not just about the Trayvon Martin case. Now it's about your kids. It's about other kids.
2 days after the verdict, another juror, B37, spoke to Anderson Cooper on CNN.
I think both were responsible for the situation they had gotten themselves into. I think both of them could have walked away.
There were some things that the other juror said that you wanted to respond to.
B37 used the word we. I guess because we were in the jury together, She put it all as in a group. And the way she made a lot of us sound was, we walk by color. And that's not what I do.
And that was something that a lot of people from the outside thought must have been the discussion in the deliberations about race, about color, but that wasn't the case?
It was not the case.
In their first vote, B37 told CNN three jurors wanted not guilty. One wanted murder, second degree, and two wanted manslaughter.
What was your first vote?
My first vote was second degree murder.
How did you go from, in 9 hours, from feeling he was guilty of second degree murder to not guilty?
In between the 9 hours, it was hard. A lot of us that wanted to find something bad, something that we could connect to the law, because for myself, he's guilty. Because the evidence shows he's guilty.
He's guilty of
killing Trayvon Martin. But as the law was read to me, if you have no proof that he killed them intentionally, you can't say he's guilty.
What was going on in your mind, your heart?
I was the juror that was going to give him the hung jury. Oh, I was. I fought to the end.
Do you have regrets that you didn't?
Kind of. I mean, I'm the only minority, and I felt like I let a lot of people down.
This polarizing case began in a gated community in Sanford, Florida. On February 26, 2012, Martin was walking back to a house where he and his father were staying. He caught the attention of the self-appointed neighborhood watch captain, George Zimmerman, who called police.
This guy looks like he's up to no good or he's on drugs or something.
They suggested he stay in his car.
Are you following him?
Yeah.
Okay, we don't need you to do that.
What happened next is in dispute, but there seems to be no question there was an altercation loud enough so that multiple neighbors called 911. At issue, who was the attacker?
Oh, my God. It's someone to be shot. Yes, the person is dead laying on the grass.
Zimmerman fired one gunshot and killed Trayvon Martin. Those 911 calls were believed to be crucial pieces of evidence.
Whose voice did you think it was on the 911 call?
I have never really paid mind to whose voice it was. Because the evidence shows that people's voices change when you're in extreme motion.
During the trial, the FBI's audio expert did testify that it is impossible to tell who was screaming for help. During their 16 hours of deliberations, the consideration of a possible manslaughter verdict weighed heavily on Maddie.
When you all sent that note to the judge asking for an explanation on manslaughter, what was that about?
What we were trying to figure out was manslaughter, in order to be charged, we had to prove that when he left home, he said, I'm going to go kill Trayvon Martin.
Her own lawyer, David Chico, says even legal experts would have been confused.
And I've thought a lot about it, and I haven't really been able to come up with another charge. Except, I mean, I think manslaughter was a charge that could be put forth.
Maddie says she had no idea that the world was watching so closely.
Solidarity!
After the jury was released, she says she crumbled as the negative news reports about their verdict erupted.
I literally fell on my knees and I broke down. My husband was holding me. I was screaming and crying. And I kept saying to myself, I feel like I killed him. And I feel that if they would put the law and a lot of people would read it, they would understand the choices that they gave us.
She says the choices she made, she still stands by today.
Where do we go from here?
My hope is that we stop walking around looking at color.
That also seemed the hope of the devastated parents of Trayvon Martin, who have been giving a kind of master class in forgiveness.
We continue to pray that, that we'll find peace and strength to be forgiven parents.
What would you like to say to Trayvon's parents?
I would like to apologize because I feel like I let him down. I didn't know how much importance I was into this case because I never looked at color. And I still don't look at color.
For Nightline, Robin Roberts, New York.
Okay. So give me an indication. Are we on? Okay, thank you. So we have to look at the station house. That's been my position from the word go, and I haven't changed that. But in the courtroom itself, we have another scenario developing that tells us something more. And it tells us that the law, especially in cases where the outcome is to be predicted or to be predictable, they can carefully choreograph it so that they get exactly the result that they want. And from the very beginning, the result that was desired was that George Zimmerman would not be convicted of this crime. And that decision was demonstrated the very night of the crime because they let him go. And for 44 days, he was unavailable to the prosecutor's office, which is most unusual. This raises a question then of what happened in the court. And this is part of the scenario that always happens. It happens in cases like this. I've seen it time and time again. It would look like a trial. It would look like people seriously are, doing battle on the basis of the law. But really, they know the outcome. And if you watched George Zimmerman's face and the face of the attorney standing next to him, you get the very uneasy feeling that they already knew. They were already told. So let's look at the scenario in the court today. I just want to go through this with you. We talked about the importance of looking at the environment in which a thing occurs, because that also gives you some very important information. The environment in this case was almost all white. In a town where African Americans and Latinos together comprise the majority of the population in Sanford, and that is according to the website, Sanford's own website, it was very telling that the only juror of color that they could find was this woman, Maddie. And what she said was very profound in that interview, the course of the interview with Robin Roberts. She said she felt like she was dragged into the whole thing. And she is not wrong. She is not wrong. To give the impression or to give the illusion of justice, of course, they packed the jury. All of the alternates were white. And they needed, it was just going to be just way too old-style Florida to have a completely 100% white jury and alternate jury. So they said, okay, let's put some melanin in there, and they got Maddie. And as you can tell, she's a woman of faith, and she's a mother of eight, and she has a particular feeling about things. And her feeling about things, again, falls on the line of predictability. As a person of deep faith, she felt compelled to listen to the law, the instructions given by the judge in this case. And, of course, when the judge reads the instructions, by the time the judge reads an instruction in the case, it is because both the prosecutor and the defense agree on the terms that would be discussed in the judge's instruction and what the judge will instruct the jury to say and not say. Okay. Now, this jury was also a sequestered jury, which most competent trial lawyers really hate. Because when you have a sequestered jury, that jury for 24 hours a day is in the custody, literally, of the enemy. Because the guards may have access to them in a way that other people will not have access to them. And in a situation like this, where the defendant was a would-be cop, he was familiar enough with police locally in Sanford that he rode around in the squad cars with them on certain tours. He had expressed openly an interest in being a police officer. So he was familiar with the police in that area and they with him. Now, you notice that he had a phalanx of security people who, of course, you don't have to ask. You just look at them and you see ex-cop written all over them. And when that jury is sequestered, they're sequestered under the care of people who know the cops. Now, when a jury is by itself, these cops, you have no idea what information is being transmitted between the police or how these, I'm not suggesting that this is what happened. I'm suggesting, though, that the scenario did exist. Because when in 100% isolation, you have no idea who is talking to the jury and what it is they're saying. But we did get some indication from juror B37, as she called herself, the one who wanted to write a book and make a profit off of her her days on the jury, that she felt that they were both at most they were both responsible for the crime of, you know, making this thing get out of hand, an escalated situation. And therefore, Trayvon Martin, as she saw it, was in part responsible for the fact that he was shot dead. If he had just walked away, if he had had the discipline to walk away, and if George Zimmerman had had the discipline to walk away, there would not have been a murder that night. That is her assumption. But what jury, this particular juror, tells us now, raises a question about what a jury should be prepared to do in a court of law. Most jurors don't think they ought to be prepared to do anything, except they listen to the case, they look at the evidence, and they go off in a room, and they argue and debate among themselves, and they're supposed to come up with a verdict based on the law as instructed. Well, what happens as in this particular case, which this juror is saying, that the law did not make sense? She could not make sense with the law. She had a gut feeling, and in her mind it was very deep-seated because that was her first vote for conviction on second-degree murder. But as the law was written, she says, and as they were instructed, she could not make that leap. And don't forget, she's a woman of deep, apparently deep religious conviction. as much as she wants to do the right thing and based on her feelings, she felt compelled to do the right thing based on, as she said, Zimmerman got away with murder, but he's not going to escape God. That tells you where her mindset is. Now, so the question is, what should a jury do when in its own mind, the law does not make sense? Well, would you be surprised to know there's a thing called jury nullification? It is a defense mechanism for the jury itself. Jurors under jury nullification can decide to ignore the law and vote whatever they believe is the right vote, irrespective of the instruction of the judge, irrespective of the instruction of the juror, of the defense and the prosecutor. That was the whole point of jury nullification. Now, jury nullification is not well tolerated in the ranks of the courts, but it is a defense mechanism, and it is the affirmation of a juror's right, because the whole question now comes up to what rights and powers do jurors have? Are you a bump in a log? You sit in a seat and you're occupied for as long as the trial lasts, and then you go off like a lemming, and then you come back with a verdict. What if the law does not make sense? Now, you'd be amazed that there's a huge effort afoot in the United States to raise this question about jury nullification, because the preponderance of injustices committed in the U.S. courts just has become so intolerable that even jurors feel attacked. And this is exactly what this juror is talking about. She felt literally dragged into something she didn't want to be dragged into. And the consequences are quite severe, as she describes it. She can't eat, she can't sleep. This matter weighs heavily on her mind. You know, here's a mother of eight. She needs to have her mind straight to deal with eight kids. But she's suggesting that this thing has sidelined her. So the rights of the juror should be now a very important question, especially within the African American community, the Latino community, communities that historically have been receiving the wrong kind of justice. This panel of six women, we are to believe, was a jury of George Zimmerman's peers. Okay. Did somebody have a sex change operation here? Six women, most of them white. They are a jury of George Zimmerman's peers. And they're telling you he got a fair trial. And they know why. Because the people on the panel reflect a mindset. We talked about that before. George Zimmerman, by the time he became officially known to them as a defendant, was also white by proxy by the time he sat in that chair. He had not only invoked the standard, he exercised the standard. And the standard was that it is derived from white supremacist thinking. I have a right to kill you if for some reason you psychologically threaten me. I feel threatened by you, so I could kill you. I could eliminate you. And that's exactly what he did. So to that degree, it's not really so, abhorrent because it is so pervasive in our system, our criminal justice system. So by the time you end up in it, even as in this situation, as the person aggrieved, who is also deceased, the cards are stacked against you big time. And I'm submitting to you today that perhaps one of the ways to kind of put a damper on that is to begin a massive education program with respect to jury nullification. Jurors or potential jurors should now be educated, and as much as every day by the thousands, people are coming before the bench and they're being routinely put in jail and they're being convicted of crimes because the prosecutor has total sway over a grand jury. It was said at one point the Chief Justice of New York State said you can indict a ham sandwich if you were a DA. So the response has to be on the part of jurors or would-be jurors. And jurors, therefore, could be the wedge for justice in the court of law. Knowing, if they are educated, that they can decide to ignore the law. They can decide to affirm their right to disagree vehemently with the law. And they are well within their law. They're well within the law to do that. What if we had in that courtroom this juror B29, who had walked into that process knowing that as a juror, she could disagree with the law. And she could say, there is nothing so far in this courtroom that is offered that makes me change my mind that George Zimmerman was a murderer that night. And what if we had all throughout these various states where we have huge populations, especially of young Black and Latino males, just going straight into the criminal industrial complex, if they actually came upon jurors who were, I should say, well acquainted with their rights as jurors, and maybe we need to take a look at jury nullification across the board. So I'm not really surprised at the outcome. As I said again, I knew what the outcome would be because anybody watching that would immediately get the information right away. You know that this is so wrong. It is so wrong. And the fact that people are concentrating on the trial, where the issue is not, the issue is in the station house. That's where it went wrong. The trial was just a way to follow through with what happened at the station house. The case was fixed in the station house that very night. The trial, I looked at George Zimmerman's face. He didn't even blink. He knew when he walked in there. He knew he had already been told what the jury decided. How? Because that's why they like sequestered juries. The people guarding them are the ones they get the information from. They knew. It was, you know, with such a heavy weight in front of him, that he might go up the river for quite a few years if he were convicted of a very serious crime. You would think if the jury did come back with a not guilty verdict, you would see it register on his face a great sigh of relief. But no, when he walked in, he had an attitude, and the camera focused on him as they read the jury's verdict. And it was like, okay, great, they did the right thing after all. No deviation from what I was told. So jury nullification is a way to go. That's right. Jurors have to insist that they have rights too. And they have to now become, everybody, I think, should be aware of your role as a potential juror. Because I'm just looking statistically, how many people routinely are just, you know, you get arrested for some crime and they don't even bother with the business of really affording you any kind of justice. You know, it's understood. You're going to jail. All right, that's it. The evidence may not be there, but it doesn't matter. How many people have been wrongfully convicted? And then the juries, the people who are questioned on these juries, they tell you about the misgivings that they had and the questions that they had and the trouble that they had with the conduct of the prosecutor, especially. Then we have to fight as jurors, and jurors have to fight back. You can't walk into a courtroom now as a kind of blank slate. You can't walk into a courtroom completely defenseless. You now have to have some kind of way of saying, I will not recognize this law because it just does not make sense to me. And I don't have to vote according to what you tell me. That's a juror's right. And that is why there's such a vehement fight against it. No judges want jury nullification at all in their courts. In some cases, they even try to convict you of persuading a jury. If you were outside of a courtroom and you handed out literature to people who were being considered to be called for jury duty, they'll tell you, oh, you're engaging in jury nullification. Yeah, well, that's okay, too. At some point, we will have to get really aggressive about this thing. So think about that. We'll take a break, and we'll come back and talk about Mr. Snowden right after this. Well, you're listening to Lead Stories on PRN.FM. I'm Eutrice Lead. And things are heating up around Edward Snowden. The Zimmerman trial has clearly seeped too deep into my brain. Well, the U.S. Attorney General has assured Russia that if Edward Snowden were to be returned to the United States, he can be assured he will not be tortured, and he could be assured of a fair trial. But in the meantime, Mr. Snowden has been literally grounded at the airport in Moscow for more than a month now, and the future seems uncertain. Is he going to get asylum somewhere? To get asylum somewhere, he's got to get to that somewhere first. And in the meantime, although Russia had extended a temporary, at least it didn't extend it, it said it would consider extending temporary asylum to him until he could figure out how to get to wherever it is he's going next. But certainly the Russian government is getting quite impatient with this guest, and they think he has overstayed his welcome. What is the next move for Mr. Snowden is that he's got to get to wherever it is he has to go or wants to go or others have agreed to have him go. And to do that, he's going to have to get out of the airport. Now, technically, according to Vladimir Putin, The airport is kind of like an international diplomatic land. It's no man's land. He doesn't, you know, it's off limits. And he is not in a position to compel him to go or to compel him to stay. He would like, but wants the situation resolved quickly because it's getting in the way of a bunch of other things. You know, the U.S. and Russia would like to resume their regular spying on each other. In the meantime, one of the conditions of remaining as a guest of Russia is that Mr. Snowden has to promise that while he's there, there will be no further leaks while he's in Russia. And now there's a feverish effort to try to resolve whether, in fact, this letter by Eric Holder, the U.S. Attorney General, is a signal that they have had extensive conversations and maybe even with the input of his father, who, as you recall, we talked about it here on this program, had written this letter to the U.S. Attorney General suggesting conditions under which he might be interested in coming back to the United States. So it was interesting that Ed Snowden said that he feared being tortured and he feared a kangaroo court trial that would basically find him guilty and impose a death penalty. So on these two counts, the U.S. Attorney General has informed Russia that no, the U.S. is not thinking of torturing him. And capital punishment is really off the board here. And so the door is now open to the next move. Is he going to come back? You know, I don't particularly like the whole scenario. First of all, I don't trust Edward Snowden. I better say it just like that. I just don't trust him. There's something wrong with this young man, I think. I don't trust him, and I don't know why, in his mind, we should distrust the government but trust him. And he was in the same business as the government. I don't understand that. I don't trust him. Secondly, I find it incredible that it should be so normal for somebody. And this is, again, you know, this is how the world works. I mean, just a huge line of demarcation in what, in my enculturation, is appropriate and what is not appropriate. And in his world, it is perfectly appropriate as a 30-year-old person who really never got involved with anybody at this level ever to be pretty much, you know, conversing with heads of state and calling the shots and doing this kind of stuff. It's perfectly normal to him. And that tells you something about how culture influences the way you think. For me, it's a real leap, you know. You don't just consider, well, you know, I don't know. Yes, Venezuela did offer me asylum, but I don't know if I want to go there. They don't quite measure up, you know, and besides which, I don't like their internet is way too slow for me, you know, that kind of thing. What he did, he says, was in the interest of America and the rest of the world, that he exposed the fact that the government was collecting information on a massive level, and it was. There's no doubt about it. I'm just amazed that he's amazed, because the government has always collected information. I mean, for crying out loud, the post office collects your information. The post office knows your address. I mean, everybody collects information. Zuckerberg collects information. Facebook is all about information. And information is money. But the U.S. has pretty much led the way in spying in the post-World War II era. Information is where it's at for most governments that have had a history of warfare. It's quite understandable. And as I said here before, It is not news to many people. It's news to Mr. Snowden and others that the government does this. We've been trying to tell you that for years. Nobody wants to listen. They've done this very well with other people. And they perfected the art of collecting information. And whatever the technology was required at the time, they used it. At one time, the technology was literally finding bodies of people to go send them, you know, go behind enemy lines and go into this village or go into that town and physically, you know, collect information and bring it back. But when technology advanced and we had the advent of radio waves, well, gee, it got easier. Just had to tap into the radio waves. And now with the internet and so forth, technology has assisted the government in a practice, a heinous practice that it always has had. So it's not mind-boggling to me at all. I hate to tell you. It isn't. Because we can recite chapter and verse about the government collecting information about very important people in our world, all over the world. And to some degree, of course, leading to things like assassinations and poisonings and fomented rebellions and, you know, government takeovers and all this kinds of stuff based on that very thing called spying. So I'm a bit, well, I'm not on the fence with Mr. Stewart. I just don't trust him. And I don't like the idea. I just have a very natural reaction to anybody telling me that they've done something on their own behest, at their own behest, and then my job is to come to your defense. And you have no history of involvement in my community. You have no history of it at all. And you suppose that, you know, well, I mean, it's there. I mean, that's the thinking is, hey, I'm entitled. I am entitled to special treatment because I'm a special person. And I'm doing something quite special. And I don't mean to in any way diminish for what for many people is a very significant thing. That through Snowden, they get to appreciate the enormity of the infractions of the government. But this brings me right back to the point. Why have you not been listening? Why is it that it takes an Ed Snowden for you to listen to things that people have been telling you for years? And it's specifically because the people telling you these things were not the right color. You didn't believe it. And they didn't matter in any event. But you now see yourself, and we had a discussion with one of our listeners not too long ago about this, you now see yourself as a potential victim, and you don't like it. So now it becomes a real problem. And that's a contradiction that the rest of the world will have to deal with. We've been telling you this for years. We've been carping about it. We've been screaming about it. It's not a problem. Now it's a problem because Ed Snowden, a very good white young man, has stepped forward and said, this is what is happening. And we're all supposed to say, oh my God, Lord, what a revelation. This guy is unbelievably bright. Look what he has done. He's brought us information we never had before. Well, okay. You can believe that if you wish. I have a different opinion. We have a little bit of time. You can take a call. We'll be discussing this, I'm sure, as we go. 888-874-4888 is the number to call. So on two counts, I think we need to talk about how our society basically operates on two entirely different levels. When we have a jury, and we see the abomination that occurs in a court, and it's done with the assumption that jurors are not armed, pardon the pun, when they walk into a court, and they shouldn't be armed. You're just there as a gelatinous mess, and you're expected to deliver a verdict and then go home. And it's time for juries to get a little bit combative and say, no, this law just does not make sense. It makes no sense. I cannot vote either way. I can't vote on guilty. I can't vote not guilty. It law just does make sense to me, and that's my vote. 888-874-4888. So that's it. That's where I stand today on Mrs. Snowden. I really, there's something wrong there. I have a feeling what it is, but I can't, and I won't say it just yet. But there's a feeling about Mrs. Snowden that it just is not resonating well with me at all. Hello, you're on the air. You're on the air.
Hello, how are you, Idris?
Fine, thank you. Thank you.
Right quick, you know, this whole Zimmerman case, the more and more you look at it, the more and more one would realize that a fix was in play. I mean, if you, like you said, if you look at his response, if you look at the prosecution, the manner in which they presented the case, like Austin said, the day after the opening arguments by both the prosecution and the defense, that this would be an acquittal. And the more you sit back and you look at the jurors saying things after the verdict, it was a fix totally. Because the one thing that got me was that the juror didn't understand that she could have held out and had a hung jury. Now, I've listened to numerous attorneys that be on television talking about that wasn't explained properly in the closing arguments to the jurors, and that if it was, maybe that woman would have held out a little longer. But it was definitely a fix, because the prosecution never really wanted to present the case in the first place. And,
The prosecution, as I said, the prosecutor in this case, if you ever get a chance to go online and download what she thought was passing for an indictment or a charging instrument, it was the most absurd thing you could ever see in a case that has such a serious charge attached to it. For the charge of second-degree murder, you should see what this prosecutor presented to the court as a charging instrument. And the reason that the prosecutor in the court had such difficulty was he had literally to make it up. He had to make up a story. There was no logic to the charges. And there was no backup, to say, especially when you're charging somebody with murder, you have to cite chapter and verse, but there was no such meat in that document at all. Thank you, Jay, for calling. Thanks so much. Thank you. 888-874-4888. As we come to the close of our discussion today, take a look at this issue called jury nullification and see how it applies. I think it's probably a good idea to have a national campaign about it, to get juries into the idea that they don't just have to sit there as passive people and intimidated by a judge and intimidated by defense or prosecution to come to the decision that they want them to come to, but that a juror should not be intimidated like that. When you listen to this particular juror talk, and the first one too, you hear agony. This is not an easy thing for many people, because they have to live with the consequences, especially in high-profile cases where, some nut job may just not like what the decision is and would, begin to think of doing people harm. You never know what people are thinking. So it's a huge risk that they take in the interest of expressing a civic duty. But at the same time, they are also manipulated, and they can be manipulated by very wise and wily people in the court to produce a predictable outcome. They may not themselves know it, but They're part of the orchestrated outcome. And one of the things that they can do, one of the defenses that they do have, is to affirm their rights. And they're a defense, basically, against being manipulated to come up with a predictable verdict. And I think it is important to take a look at that. And there are pros and cons. So we'll be talking about the pros and cons of jury nullification. But it is probably one of the best weapons that might be available to the people who most often are convicted in a court of law. Because if they are to be chosen, I mean, if the juries are to be coming to these decisions and get on panels and can see how these prosecutors routinely railroad cases, it's just routine. You know, you would have a prosecutor telling the defendant right there. I mean, the judge, everybody knows what's the outcome. You know, just get the manacles ready. Just get the handcuffs ready. This guy is one for Rikers Island, you know. He will go down to the tubes or something. And to them, it's just, you know, a statistic. They've gotten another notch on their belt, and they've gotten another tick on their resume. But people's lives are literally in danger, and not just the people who are defendants or plaintiffs in a case, but also the people who have to decide the outcomes of these cases. So it's a very, very tricky situation. With regard to Snowden, I'm going to follow this case, but I have an idea, and I just don't want to even say what I think, because I think it is going to be way too prejudicial. And I have no way of verifying my opinion. But as a news person, something tells me that this is huge and that he might have been watched for a very particular reason, and that he knew that he was being watched. And that is why he decided to bolt before they got to him. But I have every feeling as a reporter that he was aware that they were on to him. So have yourselves a good weekend, and we'll talk with each other again on Monday. Thank you. Take care.